You're listening to WCLV Cleveland, and now we go live and direct to the City Club, where WCLV presents the City Club Forum. On today's forum, Rabbi Daniel Jeremy Silver. And now to the City Club and City Club President Nancy Cronin.
Welcome. Welcome to the City Club of Cleveland. I'm Nancy Cronin, and today at the City Club Forum, we present part one in a two-part forum, which asks the question, can there be peace in the Middle East? Whether our interest is piqued by national concern or religious faith, we could choose no topic more appropriate for discussion at this time. Our speaker today is Rabbi Daniel Jeremy Silver of the Temple of Cleveland. A religious leader of national as well as local prominence, Rabbi Silver is former president of the National Foundation for Jewish Culture and currently is the chairman of its Academic Advisory Council. He is a member of the executive board of the Jewish Community Federation, where he chairs its Israel Task Force, and of the Synagogue Council of America. He chairs the Cleveland Congregational Plenum. A civic leader as well, Rabbi Silver is Vice President of the Cleveland Museum of Art, member of the Greater Cleveland Roundtable, and a member of the Monitoring Commission on School Desegregation. He teaches religion at Case Western Reserve University and at Cleveland State University. Rabbi Silver is a graduate of Harvard University. I've been told that he played football there, and that coming up against him was somewhat akin to coming up against God. He is also a graduate of Hebrew Union College and holds a PhD from the University of Chicago. A religious and community leader, an historian, the author of a notable book on Moses, Rabbi Silver has been described to me as one who offers the clearest insights into Jewish thinking today. To discuss the question of peace in the Middle East, Rabbi Silver.
I appreciate all those comments except the one about my football prowess, which was signally insignificant. I came across a child in our nursery school the other day, busily crayoning. I asked her what she was depicting, and she said, God. And I said to her, you know, well, no one knows what God looks like. And she looked me straight in the face, and she said, well, after I'm through, they will. Now, anyone who presumes to think that after I'm through, you will know whether there can be peace in the Middle East or how peace can be achieved in the Middle East will be disappointed, because no one knows. Neither the protagonists in the Middle East nor the diplomats in the various ministries of the world. The Middle East is a cauldron. The Middle East is going through the Renaissance and the Reformation and the Industrial Revolution and the Technological Revolution and the Information Revolution. It has a long way to go. Many of the countries in the Middle East are in the same place that Christian Europe was at the beginning of the Hundred Years' War, trying to sort itself out, caught up in any number of quarrels, internecine quarrels. Time alone will ultimately bring some degree of stability to the Middle East. So the best one can do, I think, is to take a very narrow look at one of the problems of the Middle East, and perhaps to extrapolate from that issue some approaches which may be useful. And that's what I'd like to try and do with you this morning. I'd like to concentrate on the Lebanon. I'd like to first ask the questions we've all been asking and see whether or not the answers we've been getting satisfy us, and if not, what ought to be our policy, our American policy, in that part of the world. So the question we've all been asking, what are the Marines doing in the Lebanon? And the answer we've all been getting, They are there as part of a multinational peacekeeping force. Question: how can a few thousand soldiers hunkered down in defensive bunkers bring peace to a country where everybody seems to be at the throat of his neighbor? Answer: they are there as part of our symbolic commitment to the Lebanese government. Now, these are the questions we've been asking, and these are the answers we've been getting, and I don't think many of us are satisfied by these answers. We know that peacekeeping must be an active enterprise. You can't have peace and security in a city if all of the police officers spend their duty hours in the police station. And we know also that if we are a symbol of our commitment to the Lebanese government, there must be something active, positive, accomplishful about that kind of symbolism. And then in reality, all that's happened in this defensive, passive posture which has been adopted is that our troops have become targets of opportunity for anyone who feels that he has some real or feigned reason to be angry with the West or with the United States in particular. And so there is the cry rising here and there among us to bring the boys home. Now, perhaps we ought to remove the multinational force. But at least before we do, let's ask the basic questions. Why are they there? And let's remember as we try to answer these questions that they are not there because it is part of a unilateral policy of the United States. They are there because they were requested by the Lebanese government and because four of the major powers of the West, Great Britain, France, Italy, as well as the United States, responded to that request made in the fall of 1982. Now, what is the interest of the West, the free West, in an independent Lebanon? I would suggest to you that the interest of the West is twofold. We do not want the Lebanon to fall under the aegis of Syria. An independent Lebanon fits in with our geopolitical reading of what should take place in the world. We don't want a radical state allied with Iran and the Soviet Union having a major any longer of a sea coast on the Mediterranean. And we also are concerned with the Lebanon because the Lebanon is essentially our child. We have a parent's concern for the Lebanon. The Lebanon was created in the middle of the 19th century by the French for reasons which, as all political reasons, were partially economic and partially humanitarian. The economic reason was that the French and Europe generally wanted to have an outpost in the Middle East from which they could do business with a part of the world which they recognized was beginning to emerge into some kind of economic prosperity. But there was another reason. Traditionally, this area of the Lebanon had been the area to which Christian groups, minorities in the Arab world, and some sectarian Muslim groups like the Druze had come in this early in the medieval period and settled in, seeking their security from the imperialism, the religious imperialism of Orthodox Islam. The French, in other words, created the Lebanon in part to be an area where these minorities could live and survive without being threatened by the subversion of an Islam which was feeling its oats and feeling its power. Now, much of the concern which we have had about our policy in Lebanon has been based on the fact that it is the common wisdom that there has never been a nation called the Lebanon. The Lebanon is an artificial creation, fundamentally unstable, and that therefore any attempt by the West to create a Lebanon is to create a house of cards which will easily topple from pressures within and without. Now, Lebanon is a fragile state, but I think it is well to remember before we read off this attempt by the West to create this country and to give it some sense of security, that for the better part of this century, until the late 1960s and early 1970s, the Lebanon, however fragile its political arrangements may be, was a relatively secure place as the Middle East goes, and that security had turned the Lebanon into the most prosperous country in the Middle East. Beirut had been the most, had become the most prosperous capital in the Middle East. The banks of the West and the banks of the Arab world met there. Much of the business of the Arab world was done in Beirut, and that prosperity was seeping out into the countryside. If it had not been for foreign intrusion, if it had not been for those who imposed themselves on the Lebanon from the outside, I think I'm convinced that the prosperity of the Lebanon would have continued, and the security of the Lebanon would have been such as to be able to sustain itself. But then in 1970, 1971, the major military and political leadership of the PLO came to the Lebanon. You recall that the Palestine Liberation Organization was created in Egypt in the middle 1950s. Its desires to be part of Nasser's program to drive Israel into the sea corresponded nicely with the general's ambitions. But Nasser quickly discovered that the PLO had other political fish it wanted to fry, that it was armed, it could not easily be controlled, and within a year or two, he had driven the PLO out of Egypt. The Syrians found a way of restraining the many-sided and varied political and military ambitions of the PLO by simply conscripting the local PLO into the Syrian army. And there is now an al-Sa'ika division of the Palestinians in the Syrian army. The Palestinians then move their political and military base to the weaker of the states which border on Israel, first to Jordan. And Jordan, for a number of years, tolerated the presence of the PLO, and it was from Jordan that many of the terrorist attacks were mounted against Israel. But by 1970, King Hussein had recognized that the PLO was a threat to his throne and to the stability of his country, and he recalled that he engaged in a major pitched battle in order to drive the PLO out and to free his country of their unwanted presence. And so the PLO moved their headquarters and their military leadership and their soldiery to the weakest of the countries which face on Israel, to the Lebanon. And it is with the introduction of the PLO into the Lebanon that the tragedy of the Lebanon begins. Because as the PLO moved into this country where relationships between these minorities have always been tenuous, where the political structure was an arbitrary structure designed by the government of Lebanon and by the outside powers deliberately to maintain some kind of effective modus vivendi between the minority groups, the PLO simply came in, muscled aside the Falange, the Maronite Christians from their centers in Sidon and Damour, pushed aside the Shiite Muslims from other centers in southern Lebanon, pushed the Druze back up into the Shuf Mountains, and carved out for themselves what was in effect a quasi-state, where they were in effect the dominant rulers of that state. And then they began not only to push aside and muscle aside these groups, but to provide arms and equipment and terrorist training to the more radical of the groups. And soon, because everything was now in confusion, these fragile relationships which had survived during most of our century were frayed, and militia began to fight against militia. Everyone armed himself, and Lebanon fell into a civil war. It was a tragic, costly, bloody civil war in 1975 and 1976, a war which turned every one of these militias into a group fighting every other of these various minority groups. The PLO brought war and bloodshed to the Lebanon and also brought in the Syrians, because the government in Beirut found itself incapable of maintaining even the semblance of order, even in its own capital. And Syria saw a wonderful opportunity to come in, to extend its influence in the Lebanon, something it has traditionally and historically wanted to do. Damascus has by and large been the dominant capital in that part of the world. During the long centuries of the Turkish Empire, it was Damascus that ruled this area as a provincial center, and Beirut, which was a very minor part of this province, the Vilayet of Syria. In the great heyday of Saladin and Nur ad-Din, Was it from Damascus that this whole area was governed? And Syria has always looked upon that area, which we now call the Lebanon, as part of its natural hegemony, and has had a clear and consistent policy of wanting to exert influence, either directly or indirectly, in the Lebanon. The Syrians sent in divisions of their army. They kept major parts of the army in the capital. They developed what was, in effect, effective control over the eastern third of the Lebanon and the Bekaa Valley. They allowed the areas of the Lebanon to remain in internecine warfare because it suited their purpose, and they saw themselves now as reestablishing their rightful authority in the Lebanon. They brought more violence and more bloodshed, and they simply settled in and have stayed in ever since. Now, as the PLO began to develop this almost independent state in the south, it began to develop also what every independent state has in our world, a standing army. And with money and modern equipment, tanks and cannon, heavy cannon and missiles provided by Libya and Iran and Iraq and Syria and Algeria and the Soviet Union, soon in the mid to late 70s, we began to see emerging in southern Lebanon what was in effect a major army. All that it lacked was an air force. The Israelis naturally were concerned. The Israelis spoke to the United States of their concerns. The United States cautioned patience. The United States reminded Israel that as long as it had complete control of the skies, and modern warfare is won in the sky, not on the land, they really had nothing to fear. And so an arrangement was made, a tacit arrangement, negotiated by the United States between Syria and Israel, a negotiation in which the Syrians agreed not to move SAM, that is, surface-to-air missiles, into the Lebanon, and Israel agreed not to take preemptive actions against this standing army that the PLO was creating. But within 6 months of this agreement, the Syrians had violated it. They had moved Russian-built surface-to-air missiles, the SAM-3s, into the Bekaa Valley, both the command units manned by the Soviet and the missiles themselves. And Israel complained to the United States, which had negotiated the original agreement, and Phil Habib was sent to Damascus, and he came back empty-handed. Damascus has had no intentions of pulling back from this extension of its influence. It was testing the reaction of the United States. It is a determined police state which knows its mind as far as the Lebanon is concerned. And the United States then, instead of taking some kind of economic or political action which would have signaled its displeasure, simply cautioned Israel to be prudent, and in so doing really laid the seeds for the inevitable preemptive action which was the invasion of the summer of 1982. Now, the United States' reaction was not only one in which it could not make good on policing a negotiation which it had been in which it had been the major partner, but it was to argue that what the real problem was that the United States had no talking points with the Syrians, that the need was to open up better relationships with the Syrians. Now, Syria is a police state. It has 30,000 secret policemen. It has to keep a division of its crack troops in Damascus in order to maintain the control of the Alawite minority, which rule the country with an iron hand. But nevertheless, the United States determined, largely, I must say, under the aegis of those in the Defense Department whose major activity is military sales to the Arab world, determined that it should see to it, if we couldn't, use the carrot instead of the stick. And incredibly, the reaction to the Syria's deliberate flaunting of these negotiations was a proposal by our administration to the Congress that Syria be included in the foreign aid bill and that several hundred millions of dollars be granted to Syria under the foreign aid sections of our legislation. Syria, determined. Syria, led by a man who has great ambition and who knows his mind. Syria saw the United States blink, and Syria moved to take full advantage of the situation. And arms began to pour in greater quantity to the PLO, and to those minorities in the Lebanon who were more radical, more allied with the Shiite Alawites and the Shiite Iranians and groups of that kind. The predictable happened. Israel was patient for a while. Its northern settlements continued to be bombed. There was greater and greater danger that it would not be able to control a PLO army backed by the Syrian Air Force and the surface-to-air missiles which controlled the air over northern Israel and southern Lebanon, and the 1982 invasion took place. Now, once the Israelis had defeated in the summer of 1982 the PLO army, and once they had totally driven out of the sky the Syrian Air Force and reduced to really ineffectiveness the SAM-3 missile centers, the United States and our Western allies were presented with a rare new opportunity. Here was a chance to engage in negotiations with all those foreign groups which had brought such tragedy to the Lebanon, the PLO, the Syrians, and the Israelis, to enter into negotiations which would see to it that all of these forces withdrew from the Lebanon. We would support the elected government of Lebanon. We would help it to extend its authority. And we would pressure that government to engage in those kinds of political reforms which obviously are necessary to readjust the political situation in Lebanon, to take into consideration the new configurations of power among the various minority groups. It was at that time that the request for the Marines and the French and British and Italian soldiers came, and the West willingly responded. But there was in being in Washington during those years, during those months, an unfortunate approach to the whole issue. And that was still that the Syrians were acting as they were acting, not because they were ambitious, not because they were going to take over the Lebanon, but simply because they were signaling their displeasure of the United States' relationship with Israel. And largely led by Caspar Weinberger, these groups, which largely set American policy for the last year, these groups argued that this was the time in which the United States should signal to the Arab world that we were in fact distancing ourselves from an ally who had done something of which we disapproved, the invasion of the Lebanon, and that we would show them by our actions that we were sympathetic to their concerns, and that we would, in fact, concern ourselves in the months ahead with seeing to it that the Israelis were shown our displeasure. And so we lost the opportunity of creating a negotiation which would involve the Syrians as well as the Israelis. We set the Syrians aside. We brought the Israelis and the Lebanese together. We even told the Lebanese government at the time, you don't have to create peace with Israel. That's not really what you need to do. We simply want an arrangement in which the Israelis will agree to withdraw. And they succeeded after some months in May of 1983 to force the Israelis to such an agreement. Force in the sense, not in the sense that the Israelis have any long-term ambitions, territorial ambitions in the Lebanon, but because the Israelis recognized quite readily how stupid the American policy was. That the American policy of not involving the Syrians was a guarantee that this agreement, whatever it was, would never in fact go into effect, because it still spoke of the coordinated withdrawal of all foreign forces. What was the argument of Caspar Weinberger? His argument was that you didn't have to worry about Syria, because once the Israelis had agreed to withdraw, once the United States had signaled its displeasure with Israel, Syria would willingly withdraw. Why would Syria withdraw? Because Syria would recognize that she could gain great interest and influence with the United States by such an act, and because the Saudis, our great allies, would bring pressure upon Syria to do that. The Saudis have, over the last many years, provided the basic support which allows the nearly bankrupt economy of Syria to survive. They had provided, between the summer of 1982 and the spring of 1983, nearly $2 billion of dollars to the Syrians, the dollars which the Syrians used to rebuild their army with new and more sophisticated Soviet equipment. It was felt that all the Saudis had to do was to go to Damascus to tell Mr. Assad that they felt that they had gained with the United States all that could be gained. The United States had distanced itself from Israel, and now was the time for the Syrians to further the interests of the Arab world and to further the involvement of the United States with positive forces in the Arab world. Now, the Saudis had no real interest in accomplishing this. They are not at all interested in sectarian Muslim groups and protecting them, or in protecting Christian Arabs in the Muslim world. Christian Arabs are not allowed to live in Saudi Arabia. Nor did they have, in fact, talking points, in our sense of the word, with the Syrians. True, they gave $1 billion or more a year to the Syrians, but this was protection money, not leverage money. It was the kind of money that the a small shopkeeper gives to the representative of the mafia in order that he can continue to stay in business. The Saudis are deathly afraid that the Syrians will arm and send down the saboteurs and the subversive literature, which will ultimately make the poor Arabs, mostly northern Arabs who work in the oil fields, dissatisfied with their lot and able to do something about taking over the black gold and all the power and wealth that it represents from the feudal lords who now have full advantage of its profits. And so they've been essentially buying the Syrians off. And Syria, of course, simply once the Israeli-Lebanese agreement was signed, simply again said no. We want no part of it. The only issue, as far as we're concerned, is the unilateral withdrawal of the Israelis. And Syria, emboldened by the weakness, by the appeasements which they had seen in Washington particularly, Syria, emboldened, began to redouble her efforts to enlarge her sphere of influence throughout that part of the world. And what'd she do? She gave tanks and cannon to dissident groups within the PLO, to drive the Arafat group first out of the Bekaa Valley and then out of the northern area around Tripoli, a task which she just recently accomplished. Now, what is her argument with Arafat? Not that Arafat has been more willing to negotiate on Israel's existence, but rather that Arafat has been unwilling to submit the PLO to the full authority of the Syrians. And the Syrians then went ahead and they provided the heavy cannon and the tanks, which were used by the Druze to force the Falange out of the Shuf Mountains and to gain control of the heights which overlook Beirut. And then she gave the arms to the Shiite Amal, with which they have been sniping away at the multinational force and trying to protect their turf in West Beirut and elsewhere in the Lebanon. And then she provided the support, the explosives, the training, to the Iranian volunteers who are in the Baalbek region, who ultimately launched those terrifying explosive truck-led explosive attacks, which destroyed our embassy and the French headquarters and then the American Marine General headquarters with such a high casualty loss. Now, the Syrians, in other words, have responded to appeasement as most dictatorships, most ambitious countries respond to appeasement by taking advantage of every opportunity which they sense along their way. They have, over the last year, weakened the Western's position in Lebanon seriously, and they have caused many American French lives to be taken, and they have created greater havoc than had existed before. They have directly opposed our purposes. Yet we continued. We continue to try to use the carrot. Our interests are in supporting the Lebanese government. It is clear that the Lebanese government must be pushed to political reform, that there must be some reconciliation between all of the warring minorities. The United States has been pressuring for a conference of reconciliation. We found that the Syrian supported minorities could not move without Syrian support. The Syrians said they would not allow these groups to go to Geneva unless they went to Geneva with them. We agreed. So everyone went to Geneva a month ago, and what happened? Instead of dealing with the domestic issues of the Lebanon, instead of dealing with political reform, Geneva dealt really only with one issue: the demand by the Syrians that all of the parties in the Lebanon denounce the Israel-Lebanese treaty, which is to say that all the parties in the Lebanon, including the duly elected central government of Lebanon, denounce the Western interests in the Lebanon and agree to accept Syrian leadership in all such areas. That conference broke up without any major success. But by now, the degree of violence, the degree of frustration in the West had mounted to the point when clearly Washington had to begin to rethink its positions. In the last month, you have seen a movement away from the Caspar Weinberger policies of appeasement to a more active policy, which is willing to retaliate against when there is direct attack on the Western forces, a retaliation which unfortunately has only proven how obsolete many of the weapons are that are available in our arsenal there to take effective use against those who are attacking us. We're fighting them with a battleship which was mothballed 10 years ago or more because the admirals knew that in the era of missile warfare, battleships are outdated, they're sitting ducks. We sent carrier planes against Baalbek, but we sent very slow subsonic planes because that's all we really fly, that are bombers off of these carriers, and two of them were shot down and another was seriously damaged. The problem is that we now had to take a new look at our commitment. Were the reasons for that original commitment still valid? I believe they still are. The West, it is to the West's advantage for many reasons to maintain, to sustain, and to support an independent government in the Lebanon. Can we just walk away and leave Lebanon to the Lebanese? If we could leave Lebanon to the Lebanese, it might be wise to walk away. But if we leave Lebanon to the Lebanese, we're not leaving Lebanon to the Lebanese, we're leaving Lebanon to the not-so-tender mercies of the Syrians. And Syria is a police state. And Syria is a country which has shown that it is willing to turn its own guns against its own people. I remind you of Hama, the fifth largest city in Syria, whose center was destroyed by the Syrian army because there were those in the center who opposed the government of Mr. Assad. It will take patience. It will take perseverance. It will take pressure on Gamayel and the others in the central government to open up the authority of the government to other interests. But you know, Syria is not a superpower. Syria is a nearly bankrupt government, which is afraid of internal dissension. That's why it is a police state. It is governed by a man named Assad, who in fact may be incapacitated at the moment from government. We are likely to see a power struggle among the minority Amalite group who rule that country, who are opposed by many within the country. We are likely to see that there are domestic problems. Syria is a country which is much disliked in the Arab world. Syria cut the pipeline by which Iraq exports oil to the Mediterranean. Syria and Iraq have long been at loggerheads. Syria is disliked because of its radical pro-Soviet activities. Syria is disliked because of its radical, anti-traditionally Islamic proclivities. There is no reason to believe that if we can persevere, that Syria will remain as she is now, and that those groups who are supported by Syria, if they sense American Western resolve, will not slowly disengage themselves from their Syrian support and find reasons to move to consolidate their interests with those of other parties in the Lebanon. The Druze, who are completely now supported by the Syrians, are an independent community. They are strongly independent and have no wish to be dominated by any group outside their own. And given half a chance, if they had half a reason to believe that the Western resolve was a constant resolve, I'm convinced that they would very quickly begin to show greater willingness to cooperate with Beirut towards creating some kind of political reform and independent, sustainable, independent Lebanon. Now, there are no guarantees and there are no solutions. There's no way that anybody can stand at this rostrum or any rostrum and tell you that if we keep our troops in the Lebanon, we will in effect be able to make out as we propose to make out, that is to help sustain an independent Lebanese state. The Middle East is not a predictable area of the world. But I would suggest to you that the risk is worth the taking, because to give up now, before we have really tried our patience and our principles, before we have really given up on and recognized how foolish our policies of the last year and developed other policies, is to write off several millions of people who will be put under totalitarian rule. It is to expose minorities to the not-so-tender mercies of a police state. And it is to weaken our own ability to deal with the rest of the countries of the Arab world, those countries which have depended upon our support, who have felt that the West is a dependable ally. And let me close by extrapolating from what has happened in Lebanon to the whole question as it affects Israel and the United States. As part of this new policy of trying to contain the Syrian influence, the United States in November, at the end of November of this year, signed with Israel a memorandum or an agreement on strategic cooperation. This agreement is simply the statement that the Israelis are the only major army in place on which the United States can depend, and that they can in many ways be supportive of American activities in that part of the world. We saw last week the first evidence of this cooperation when Israeli convoys and Israeli tanks went into the Shuf Mountains on pre-arrangement and were able to bring out from Deir al-Kamar 2,000 Falange soldiers and some 5,000 Falange civilians who had been besieged there for several months, diffusing, at least in that one area, one of the many problems with which the Lebanon abounds. But I must say to you, reading as I do very carefully the Israeli press, that the Israelis did not greet this new agreement on strategic cooperation with great glee. They are as concerned as our other pro-Western countries in the Middle East with the inconsistency and sometimes the downright foolishness of American policy. There was, in being 3 years ago, a very similar memorandum of strategic cooperation between the Israeli government and the United States government. It was in being for all of 3 months until it was unilaterally denounced by the American government, which was angered when the Israeli government announced that it was bringing its administration, its rules of administration, to play in the Golan Heights. Mr. Begin at that time had some major problems with his own domestic problems. He had just completed the withdrawal from the Sinai. He had to dismantle a major Israel town, Yamit, and in order to solve a number of domestic issues, he had announced this purely administrative issue, and the United States government used it as a pretext to get in a high dudgeon and denounce this memorandum of strategic understanding. Now, allies often do things which we do not approve of, and we do things of which our allies do not approve of. But if there is to be a long-term commitment, a really meaningful commitment which will be understood by all the parties in the Middle East, that commitment must somehow run through thick and thin. The Israelis are concerned that this new agreement will last only as long as America feels weakened in the Lebanon. They are concerned, moreover, that America's indecision has made it increasingly difficult for Israel to even consider negotiations on outstanding issues with those in the countries which surround it. As long as the Arab world felt that the American-Israeli relationship was steady and was strong, we began to hear in the late 70s and early 80s more and more talk about the willingness of some so-called moderate Arab governments to negotiate with Israel, to accept the existence of Israel. But the minute we began this policy of appeasement in the Lebanon, and it became clear that America was distancing itself from Israel, these voices were muted and silenced. And we've heard very little talk in the last year of the possibility of increased negotiations. The Arab states increasingly have simply denounced the Reagan plan and any other plan which has been put forward. Why should they negotiate when in fact they feel that Israel will be increasingly weakened, that it will be increasingly distanced from its major military supplier in the United States? What I'm saying is simply this, that if, as I believe, the major equation which deals with peace in the Middle East is that of time, if somehow the countries in the Middle East must last out the next decade or two while a great deal of change takes place in the Middle East, then it is crucially important that the United States sort out its priorities and remain consistent in support of those priorities. If, as it is clear, one of those priorities is an independent Lebanon, then let us make sure that the Arabs understand this, Syria in this case, and let us take those measures which will, as far as possible, support the possibility of maintaining an independent Lebanon. And if, as been America's stated policy for the last 35 years and more, that we support and understand the existence of a major, strong, democratic ally in the Middle East, in Israel, then let the United States make very clear by its actions that we do, in fact, think of Israel as an ally, and that we will not back down from it when occasionally it takes actions in its own interests, which the United States, for one reason or another, seems not to approve of. It's terribly important that this kind of consistency be signaled to the rest of the world, because only when the rest of the world understands the terms of this relationship can there be any opportunity for peace. When the new agreement on strategic cooperation was signed, Mr. Scholz happened to be in Europe. He left Europe for some meetings in Tunis and in Morocco, and he was met there by anger from the so-called moderate Arab states about this new agreement with Israel. And he said, in effect, to these leaders, there's nothing new in this agreement which has not been, in fact, the fact for the last, since 1948. What he neglected to say is that the actions of Israel of the United States over the last several years had created the question in the minds of these Arab leaders that whether or not this strong, steady relationship in fact existed. And what they were reacting to was frustration that the United States was now reasserting what had always been basic American policy. I wish at this season of the year I could stand here and tell you that peace is around the corner in the Middle East. There's an easy way to achieve it. Peace is not around the corner in the Middle East, and there is no easy way of achieving even the kind of dampening down of the violence which we have seen there. But I do know this, that peace is a greater possibility in the Middle East if Washington is clear as to its mind and if Washington has a mind. And it is for that I pray at this season. Thank you.
Thank you, Rabbi Silver. Today at the City Club, we are listening to Rabbi Daniel Silver speaking on possibilities for peace in the Middle East. And in just a few moments, we'll turn to our traditional question period. But first, some brief announcements. There are no high school students with us here today, so that gives me a chance to say a word about Christmas and holiday and New Year shopping. Okay? If you still have a few names on your list, if you need a gift or two, why not stop by the office of the City Club and pick up a membership in the City Club? You can get a year's subscription to the City Club or a quarterly subscription. The year's subscription, I guess, is if you're sure it's for someone you love. If you're not real sure, you can give a quarterly subscription, okay? Next week, we'll be dealing with the Middle East question again, this time from a different point of view. Our speaker will be Jim Lipscomb, now director of the Gunn Foundation. But before coming to Cleveland for 7 years, he was the Ford Foundation's representative in Egypt, living in Cairo. He'll speak to us next week on myth and reality in the Middle East. Be sure to make your reservations early for this important address. And now for our questions for Rabbi Silver. We have two microphones, one in the front with Alan Davis, and one in the rear with old, Bob Conrad, of course. And now for our questions for Rabbi Silver.
Rabbi, you've mentioned, and it seems rather clear, that Syria will be told what to do in Lebanon by the Saudi Arabians. My question is, how much influence does America have on the Saudis? And how much influence does the Saudis have on the Syrians?
If I suggested that Syria will be told what to do in the Lebanon by the Saudis, I misstated. I don't think I suggested that. I suggested that Mr. Weinberger believes that the Saudis are able to tell the Syrians what to do in the Lebanon, and that they're able to do so because of the large amounts of money that the Saudis give to the Syrians. I believe quite the reverse to be the case. The Saudis are afraid of the Syrians. The Saudis are a small feudal oligarchy sitting on top of rich gold fields, black gold. And the Saudis are afraid of subversion because the oil fields are run by Palestinians, by Syrians, by Iraqis, who are not allowed to share fully in the wealth that they are bringing out of the earth. And the Syrians are the agency through which the Soviet, the Libyans, the Iranians, and others can ship down weapons and subversive materials and subversive propagandists in order to stir up the oil fields if they wish. That essentially the Saudis are buying off the Syrians, and it is my firm belief that Syria's ambitions in the Lebanon begin in Syria, are determined by Syria, fit Syria's concepts of her role in the Arab world, which she wants to be a dominant one, and will be limited only insofar as Syria feels that other countries will not allow her to move her troops or her influence ahead.
Rabbi Silver, I've been puzzled and somewhat astonished recently that there's been no outcry or moral condemnation in the UN or third world countries or similarly in world opinion with what I regard as a slaughter and killings by so-called rebel PLO versus the other Palestinian PLO and by the Syrian involvement in that. You don't hear any real condemnation of that. Similarly, in the Iraq-Iran war, there is no significant discussion of that. It's relatively quiet and seemingly well, the world is unconcerned with it. What is the moral difference that takes place in the world with regard to that kind of violence and slaughter and massacre as against other types that are condemned?
We have, I suspect, what you would call a selective morality based, one, on what is of interest to the news media, what they can report on. One of the problems of the Iraqi-Iranian war is that the correspondents can't get to the front and report upon the slaughter, which has now reached into the tens of thousands. Another is that the media has largely a two-tiered Western bias. That is that Israel as a Western state should abide one level of moral concern. And somehow if Arabs kill Arabs, it's something lesser breeds without the law. That's unfortunate. It doesn't speak well of our own attitude towards the third world or the people who live in those in the Arab world. But it's a fact of life, and it's one which I think harms our understanding in a more basic sense than simply moral outrage, which is a relatively cheap commodity. And that is that when the terrible civil war broke out in the Lebanon in 75, 76, it was hardly covered in the world press, and therefore it hardly became an issue. And we continue to deal with Syria in the Lebanon and the PLO in the Lebanon as if nothing had happened, nothing had changed. Instead of trying to nip a problem in the bud, we let it fester. And like all things that are, all wounds that are allowed to fester, they become more and more dangerous. One of the problems that we're dealing with here is that those issues which seem to be controversial are those which are raised up in the media. Clearly here, you know, I was announced as a speaker at the City Club to talk on peace in the Middle East. Suddenly, before anybody knows what I'm going to say, there has to be an opposition speaker who's going to counter whatever it is that I have to say. Now, that's fine. This platform is devoted and dedicated to free speech. But my point is that somehow the issue of Arabs and Israel has become one of those issues, you know, which is constantly exciting of opinion in the United States. The Arab versus Arab issues do not get that same kind of coverage, though, as in the case of Iraq, Iran, North Yemen, South Yemen, poor Arab, rich Arab, the Brotherhood of Islam versus the radical Islamic groups in the Syria, they're much more important in the long run, much more basic.
Rabbi Silver, in your very clear description of the history of this mess in the Middle East, I see one thing is missing. All these people over there are members of major religions. What has happened to the religious philosophy, as I interpret it as being something for the human race, in all this mix-up? We have the Christian, we have the Druze, we have the Shiites, the Alawites, the all this. What has happened to the religious beliefs of these people?
One assumption that religions promote peace is false. And the I don't mean to play bah humbug with the Christmas spirit, but I remind you of the Crusades. I remind you of the Hundred Years' War in Europe, which was essentially a war between the Lutheran North and the Catholic South. I remind you of the terrible wars of the Middle Ages, when the Albigensians, with that very graceful civilization, were destroyed by the Catholic forces of Northern Europe. I don't think anyone should wonder that religions, you know, are involved. Religions are inevitably woven into the texture of a society, and therefore they reflect all the interests and contradictions of the society. We would like religions to deal with peace and goodwill and all of that, but that's only one side of the coin. They also deal with turf. They also deal with survival. They also deal with ambition. And at least in the case both of Christianity and Islam, both of these religions have traditionally been imperialist. That is, they have looked to the conversion of the world by force, if not by missionaries.
Rabbi, as it is common knowledge to most, every time in the past 10 years when any person on the so-called West Bank, so-called occupied territories, would attempt to start a dialogue with an Israeli government representative on negotiation of status of the Palestinians, and that person was inevitably not part of the PLO framework, that person was either maimed or assassinated by the PLO. I mean, there are many, many such incidents. Now that the PLO seems to be in greater disarray than it ever has been, would you care to hazard an opinion as to whether those moderate voices among the Palestinians will have a greater say in negotiations and an ability to bring about some negotiations with the Israeli government?
Well, Lee, I'm not sure that the PLO is in greater disarray. What has happened is now that the PLO is coordinated under and consolidated under Syrian influence. What is in disarray is Mr. Arafat's role and position. But let me answer you the question by telling you of a group that meets in Jerusalem. It's called the Rainbow Group. It's a group of Catholic priests, Dutch Reform ministers, professors at the Hebrew University, people of academics of from all of these groups who meet every 6 or 8 weeks to discuss issues of common concern. This group has been meeting for 20 years. I've had the privilege a number of times when I've been in Jerusalem to meet with them. Now, there are a number of very intelligent, very scholarly, very sensitive Qadis, Muslim teachers who live in the Jerusalem area. Over that whole 20-year period, they've made a desperate attempt, a consistent attempt, to bring some of these people into these conversations. There are no political decisions being made, but at least there should be contact. They have never been able to do so. One of the problems that we have in all of these relationships is it takes two to dance. And we have not been able, even in that kind of almost antiseptic surrounding, we have not been able to bring in leaders of the Muslim world into dialogue. And if we can't do it at that level, it's going to be a long time before we do it at the political level.
Rabbi Silver, you couldn't have given a better argument for the new international information order about how selective the Western news services are and about what news and what news they will cover. And ironically, it's that very issue that the United States is pulling out of UNESCO.
Well, the new international information order is hardly one which would encourage the fuller dissemination of information of all kinds. It's one rather designed to control it, but to control it to the benefit of groups for which it is now being controlled. It's an attempt to license reporters. It is an attempt to require reporters to publish what that particular country believes to be positive and affirmative of its activities. It's an attempt to see to it that we get a view of the third world, which the third world wants us to have, rather than a review of the realities it is. The problem is not, as far as I'm concerned, that we need this UNESCO fiasco, which would absolutely shackle the free press. But we need a free press which is more responsible to do the present job that it's equipped to do, but to do it better.
Rabbi Silver, would you comment on why the Soviet Union has not been more assertive and aggressive as we have remained there in Lebanon?
Well, the Soviet Union has been assertive in the sense that it has resupplied the Syrians with the most advanced equipment which has ever left the Soviet Union. The Syrians now have what they call SAM-5s, the newest and best surface-to-air missiles which can control that whole air corridor. They also have, and this is more dangerous to the United States, something called the SS-20, which is a surface-to-surface missile of a range of about 200 miles, which is absolutely accurate within that range, which could destroy the big guns and silence the big guns in New Jersey with one or two hits. What it has not done, beyond sending 8,000 troops into Syria, many of whom are in combat structures, what it has not done is to be more visible, because it recognizes what the United States does not yet recognize, and that is the degree to which other countries in that part of the world whose interests it would like to cultivate, namely Iraq and Iran, how these countries do not want to see Syria gain hegemony in that part of the world, particularly Iraq. And so she must tread a little bit softly in that respect.
Would you comment on the Israeli claim to Palestine as compared to the Arab claim? Were the Israelis interlopers on the Arabs in Palestine?
I saw a sign back there which said there was 1 minute to go. Let me simply say that I don't set much store at this point with historical claims. I think the Israelis have a traditional claim which we all recognize. The point is that they have a viable state. The point is that there is territory which is in dispute. The point is that territory which is in dispute cannot be resolved unless there is recognition on all sides that one can trust the parties to the agreement. And the plea that I made earlier remains, that until the United States has a consistent policy, which is consistent in fact, the Arabs have no reason to enter into serious negotiations on the West Bank or on Gaza.
Thank you. Thank you, Rabbi Daniel Silver. The City Club is adjourned.